Before I begin, I'd like to say thank you to Gene Goetzel-Myers for inviting me, and thank you all for hosting me and giving me such a wonderful welcome. I had the opportunity today to talk to your president, to the vice president, to the dean of academics, and to a number of people who are in general very supportive of the exchange program between Greifswald University and Widener University. It's wonderful to be here. It's the third time I'm here. It's good to see my students and colleagues from Greifswald, and above all, it's wonderful to see our friends again here at Widener. I should also be honest in saying that it wasn't all that easy for me to come here this time, and I should explain why. I said that I've been here three times, and as somebody who teaches American studies, mainly North American literature, it's been my privilege to come over to the United States many times in my life, usually with a stipend, with a prize, or as a guest professor. So I was always an invited guest. And sometimes when I crossed the Border Patrol would look at my passport and see the visa, and they would ask, why, you've been in the U.S. before, what were you doing there? And I always answered truthfully, teaching American literature. This usually gave me a smile and a positive reception. This time, when crossing the border from Canada, where I'm located for 1 year, I was fingerprinted. And I knew that I would be fingerprinted. And when I heard about this new policy, I thought, I'm not going there anymore. But that wouldn't be fair, because I have so many friends here. And so I came, because I believe that the exchange between, any exchange between people in Europe and people in North America, especially in this case between Germany and the US, are very, very important. Maybe even more so now that the relations are somewhat strained than they were, say, 4 or 5 years ago. When September 11 happened, as you perhaps all read in your press, I hope, there was a wave of solidarity with the American people. There were vigils, demonstrations, conveyor belts were halted, and there was a minute of silence, even in the factories, to think of the poor people who lost their lives. There were prayer vigils praying for peace, that this would lead to peace and not to more violence. And there was a wave of empathy and solidarity with America. Unfortunately, the events that followed and the rhetoric that followed, especially by somebody who is in your government and who is of German descent and has German relatives, Rumsfeld, his rhetoric led to a lot of antagonistic feelings amongst Germans. There was a certain arrogance and also a tendency to see in schemes like that dichotomize rather than unite. You're either friend or foe, that type of rhetoric. There was no understanding why people in Germany and in other countries in Europe that suffered immensely, far beyond anything that has happened in the US, that suffered immensely from the Second World War, which Germany started, that there is an unwillingness, and there was an unwillingness and still is an unwillingness, to go to war. There was no understanding for that. It was seen as an insult. It wasn't. It was a concern about peace. And I do hope that we'll find peace again. Because of the estrangement between the governments, but also between the people, because of something like fingerprinting or security checks conducted by American personnel on Canadian soil, on German soil, on French soil, sort of extraterritorial little islands of U.S. territorial sovereignty in countries that otherwise are sovereign countries. Because of the callousness with which UN resolutions are treated, because of the abandonment of UNESCO, because of some of the things that happen in the US, if you think of guns, if you think of crime, manslaughter, if you think of capital punishment, which to a lot of Europeans is just Stone Age mentality, there is an estrangement, and I'm very much aware of that. And yet I love people in this country. I love a lot of things that the US stand for, and I do not want the present shadow that is on our relationship to become so dark that communication ceases. And that is why we, the people on either side, need to talk and to come together. And that's why I'm glad that we have this exchange, and I thank you, Jean, for keeping it alive with a stamina and determination that is so characteristic of you. And also the good cheer and the positive attitude. I thank you from the bottom of my heart for that, and I do hope we can keep this thing alive. And if I can help in doing that, that's why I'm here. And I thank Heike for being here, and I thank our students for being here, and I thank all of you colleagues who've been over to Greifswald and who will hopefully come in the future for making that trip. The topic of my talk is the tragedy of Abraham and other Inuit from Labrador in Hagenbeck's Völkerschau, or Hagenbeck's People's Show, 1880-81. In the fall of 1880, a group of 8 persons from Labrador traveled to Germany in the hope of returning with some much-needed money. The small group of Inuit travelers consisted of 5 Christian neophytes from the Moravian mission at Hebron, the couple Abraham and Ulrika, their daughter Sarah and baby Maria, and the unmarried young man Tobias, and of the pagan family of Shaman Terjanyak, his wife Paingo, and their teenage daughter Nachosak, all from Nachvak, north of Hebron. They'd been recruited by the Danish sea captain Adrian Jacobsen, who was acting on behalf of Carl Hagenbeck, a trader in exotic wild animals and the founding director of Hagenbeck's Tierpark, the Hamburg Zoo, which is named after him. Abraham and his fellow travelers were hired to be exhibited at European cities as living samples of what was then seen as Eskimo culture. Their story presents one of many shameful and depressing episodes in 19th century German and other Europeans' history with regards to colonial and missionary contacts overseas. It is marked by economic greed and exploitation, by ignorance and prejudice, by scholarly and popular curiosity, and by hypocrisy, callousness, and racism. But it is also interspersed with instances of Christian compassion and humanist empathy, and by attempts made by both the Inuit guests, as well as by some of the European hosts, to meet as contemporary human beings on a person-to-person level. Within months of their arrival, all 8 members of the Inuit group died of smallpox. They might have been forgotten, like so many other victims of colonialism and racism, had not one of the group, Abraham, kept a short diary. Unfortunately, the original text of Abraham's diary, which was shipped to Hebron, Labrador, is lost. We do not even know whether Abraham wrote the Inuktitut original in Sütterlin, the old German style of handwriting, or in Latin letters. There is, however, a 14-page handwritten translation of his diary into German by Brother Kretschmer, a Moravian missionary who served in Labrador. Besides, there are 2 letters by Abraham also translated into German, and there are entries in Moravian diaries as well as letters exchanged between Moravian missionaries in Labrador and Germany. All of these handwritten sources are in the German Sütterlin style, which only a very few older people and even fewer professional experts decipher today. Besides, there are printed sources like contemporary newspaper reports, and there's one scholarly article by the Prussian, Germany's most famous physician and ethnologist of that time, Dr. Rudolf Virchow, reporting on how he scientifically examined members of the group and how during the examination, Pingo, Terjanyak's wife, tried to resist this disrespectful scientific invasion of her privacy. There's also a handwritten diary by Captain Adrian Jacobsen himself, but I didn't have the chance to read that yet. Since all manuscripts and published articles are available in German only, they remain inaccessible to the majority of people in North America, including possible descendants of relatives of the 2 families who were taken from Labrador to Europe 125 years ago. There is, however, a pioneering article by Canadian geographer J. Garth Taylor, An Eskimo Abroad, which contains several passages of the diary translated into English by Dr. Helga Taylor. Moreover, in 2 histories of the development of Inuit literature in Canada, there are quotations from and references to Abraham's diary as the first autobiographical text by an Inuit author. Apart from these publications, nothing seems to be available in English about this episode in Moravian missionary history and European Labrador relations. In Germany, there's 1 unpublished final thesis for a teacher's diploma by a former student of mine, Renate Jütting, Das Tagebuch, the Diary of Abraham. In the summer of 2002, some of my students at the University of Greifswald, Germany, and myself decided to translate all German sources available to us into English and try to have them published in Labrador. For our translation, we used Renate Jütting's photocopy of the original manuscript of Brother Kretschmer's translation of Abraham's diary, which she obtained from the Moravian archives in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where the manuscript is housed. Unfortunately, there are no traces of the Inuktitut original, which reportedly had been shipped to Hebron in 1880. Consequently, for better or worse, present scholarship has to rely on Brother Kretschmer's sometimes garbled and seemingly hasty translation, and we are never quite sure how much of the religious piety which the text documents is Abraham's own or the missionary's edition. Nor do we know how much of the faulty grammar is the result of a verbatim or an inadequate translation. When paralleled with the 2 remaining letters written by Abraham and also translated by Moravians, we must either conclude that there was a concerted missionary effort to posthumously construct Abraham as an ideal neophyte, or we may assume that indeed he remained a devout Christian to the very end. As to the grammar, there's a marked difference between a published translation of the letters and the unpublished translation of the diary. Possibly, Brother Kretschmer did not have the time or motivation to edit the translated text into smoother German. And when we read reports from Hebron, we may even conclude that some of the missionaries were gradually losing their command of German altogether. Whatever the case, Brother Kretschmer's translation is the only text we have, and the following passages are based on the English version which students and I translated from Kretschmer's German manuscript. A few words about the diary. In our own translation, we try to capture in English the awkward and grammatically flawed style of Kretschmer's text. The very first entry of Abram's diary is expressive of the Inuk's severe culture shock caused by the constant and high level of noise and the unfamiliar experience of crowds of people. Quote, "In Berlin it is not really nice, since it is impossible because of people and trees, indeed because so many children come. The air is constantly buzzing from the sound of the walking and driving. Our enclosure is filled up immediately." Again and again, Abraham expresses his shock and dismay at the unruly throngs pressing into their enclosure and even into the houses they had in the zoos where they were exhibited. In one case, neither their guardian Jacobson nor the military officers present could move the crowds to leave the compound, until finally they asked Abraham to scare off the visitors. Abraham accomplished this task with the help of a Greenland seal harpoon provided, a dog whip, and apparently his quote-unquote savage looks. "Since our two masters did not achieve anything, they came to me and sent me to drive them out. So I did what I could. Taking my whip and the Greenland seal harpoon, I made myself terrible. One of the gentlemen was like a crier. Others quickly shook hands with me when I chased them out. Others went and jumped over the fence because there were so many. Several thanked me for doing this, and our masters also thanked me very much. Ulrike had also locked our house from the inside and barricaded the entrance so that nobody could go in, and those who wanted to look in through the window were pushed away with a piece of wood." Other entries document some of the intense fear suffered by the Inuit in Germany. For November 7th, Abraham reports how Captain Jacobson beat Tobias with a dog whip for disobedience, and we do not learn the nature of his quote-unquote offense. And that afterwards, the abused was very sick. In hindsight, Jacobson must have felt remorse or have feared a scandal. Abraham mentions that the captain asked him not to report this incident to the Moravians, and that Jacobson bought silk ribbons for the women. Obviously, Abraham was aware that his literacy offered an important safeguard against future abuse, because he mentions his resolution to write to the Moravians in England should Jacobson repeat such behavior. The Inuit travelers fervently hoped for, and at the same time feared, the return voyage across the North Atlantic, which had made them seasick for a week. Their fears are reflected in Abraham's brief entry about news of ships having sunk in the North Sea. He and his Moravian family had also been instilled with a paranoid fear of other denominations, which kept them from going out in Prague, quote, "so that we may not be caught by the Catholics." In Frankfurt on the Main, on November 27th, he notes, "There are many Jews here. The Catholics are very greatly despised there." While some situations recorded may sound almost comic to us today, the diary as a whole is a rather depressing document, since despite Abraham's brave protestations to the contrary, there is an increasing sense of despair and doom. The Inuit suffered from health problems incurred from the unusually wet cold and from their isolation. For the Christian Inuit, there were contacts with and encouraging visits by the members of the Herrnhuter Brüdergemeinde, as the Moravians are called in German. The highlights of their stay we may gather from Abraham's diary were visits to an elaborate Moravian church service with much singing, praying, and music, and a tour of a Berlin wax museum, providing the Inuit an inverted and twisted colonial gaze, since the museum's ethnographic show exhibited lifelike figures of, quote, Nubians, Africans, and Chinese, and Indians, and Americans, and Californians. Yes, indeed, the inhabitants of the earth, very many did we see in Berlin, as Abraham put it in his October 27th entry. Besides, he writes enthusiastically about a military parade in Prague, and he's obviously proud of the various rides by train, tram, and sleigh, including a steam engine called Faster Than Flying Ones in a first-class carriage, which great gentlemen usually use. Occasionally, Abraham reports also about work they were paid for. For example, the ethnographic demonstrations showing how they displayed their arts and crafts, how they paddled their kayak on a pond in Berlin Tiergarten that was covered with ice they had to break first, or how they harpooned a live seal brought from Holland, upon which the audience clapped their hands greatly like the eider ducks. In addition, Abraham had to show off his civilized accomplishments, like playing the violin, making drawings, or writing his name. He also records when the intake from visitors was very low. Quote, sometimes we are given some money, sometimes 2 pence, sometimes 1 mark, sometimes 50. It is too long until the year is over, because we would very much like to return to our country, because we are unable to stay here forever. Yes, indeed, it is impossible. It buzzes and roars day and night because of the rattling of the sleighs and the constant voices of the steam whistles. A monotonous and obviously inadequate diet of hardtack, herring or cod, coffee and beer was occasionally broken by treats like fresh fruit given them by sympathetic spectators. Whenever brethren from their church came for brief visits, Abraham seems to have been filled with genuine delight, and he had high hopes of visiting the Moravian Center at Herrnhut. Gradually, however, Abraham's homesickness and longing to get back to Labrador became ever more obvious in his writings. In his letters to his former teacher, Brother Elsner in Bremen, he pours out his heart in confessions that are both religious and secular. His letters also record his economic and intellectual motives for having agreed to the voyage. He was in debt to the missionaries and hoped to earn enough to pay back his debts to the mission, and he was curious to see Europe. He tells Brother Elsner how he repents his foolish decision to have agreed to this trip. He mentions his fear of Catholics, and he expresses his fervent longing to return to Labrador, quote, to see my relatives again. In his very last letter, Abraham reports the death of his daughter Sarah and how he and Ulrika hoped that the Lord, quote, will forgive our aberration, that is, to have agreed to the trip against the Moravians' council. The last entry in the diary reads, From there we went away in a sleigh with wheels and horses in the night, all of us, to Darmstadt. In Darmstadt we had a beautiful house and a beautiful big roundhouse, which is a playground for ice skating on wheels. There we often sleighed round and round inside the house, all of us sitting on it. There one of us, Telyanyak's daughter, Nachosak, stopped living very fast and suffered greatly, terribly. After her, on another country in Krefeld, her mother also died, greatly suffering as well. After her, also little Sarah stopped living in peace and had a great rash with swellings, being swollen all over. After 2 days of being sick, she died in Krefeld. While she was still alive, she was brought to hospital, where I went with. She still had her mind while I was there. She still prayed the song, Ich bin ein kleines Kinderlein, I am a child so small. When I wanted to leave, she sent her greetings to her mother and little sister. When I left her, she slept. From then on, she did not wake up anymore. For this, we both had reason to be thankful. While she was still alive, we went away to Paris and traveled the whole day and the whole night through. That's the end of the diary. He died in Paris. While Abraham's diary and letters occasionally provide explicit expressions of his elation at meeting his brethren or enjoying sightseeing trips, the situation of Terjaniak's family must have been unbearably bleak by comparison. Throughout the trip, the two families seem to have been kept in separate dwellings. Abraham reports in his first letter to Brother Elsner, "We are very grateful that they have a home for themselves. We don't like their habits. They both practice magic. I often ask them to convert, but it doesn't help." We also learn from Abraham's few comments in the diary that as early as October 27th, the Northerners, quote, "stop being cheerful because they are tired of the people." Later on the train to Berlin, Terjaniak, according to Abraham, worked magic, but was extremely distraught by his witchcraft and couldn't smile at anyone. In his first letter to Brother Elsner, Abraham reports that Pingo is sick, very sick, but that they reject taking any medicine. They hope to get well by magic. After Darmstadt, where Terjaniak's family were wiped out by smallpox, this man must have been completely broken in spirit. Abraham reports in his last letter that, quote, "even Terjaniak, who is now alone, when I say to him that he should convert, desires to become a property of Jesus, sincerely as it seems. He constantly takes part in our prayers until this day." Abraham's short diary, I'd like to say a few things about the context now. Abraham's short diary and two letters provide subjective and necessarily limited accounts of the journey, but they cannot convey an idea of the complicated processes involved in bringing over the Inuit group, nor of what happened before and after their visit. As further textual sources to consult, there are a number of Moravian materials and so on. And from these materials altogether, I'd like to draw a few conclusions. First, about the Inuit visitors. According to Moravian sources, the Inuit of Labrador knew quite well about the economic success of a group of Greenlanders who had visited Europe as Hagenbeck's employees 3 years previously. However, we know nothing concrete about the motivation of the heathen family from Nachvak. Abraham's motivation was quite clearly economic. His kayaking the previous winter and spring had been unsuccessful, and unwilling to accept money from the Moravian alms box, he had run into debt to the tune of £10. He hoped that with the money he expected to be given in Europe, he would be able to buy a net and fish more successfully. Besides, he was curious to see the outside and hoped to visit Herrnhut and other Moravian centers in Europe. Tobias, who joined the group only the night before their departure, may have been motivated by curiosity for adventure. Now, the motivations of Captain Jakobsen and Karl Hagenbeck. They were obviously economic and professedly also scientific. Jakobsen not only recruited indigenous people for his employer's ethnographic shows, but he also collected, bought, or sometimes stole artifacts for museums in Europe. Hagenbeck, like Abraham, had had a particularly unsuccessful economic year, 1879. The trade in zoo animals had been on the decline since the mid-70s, and the shrewd businessman hoped to repeat the success of his earlier Völkerschauung, people's shows, which he'd begun in 1874 with a group of Sami people who had accompanied a herd of reindeer imported from Northern Europe. It was only a decade after the founding of the German national state, the Kaiserreich, in 1871, and the newly founded German Empire was seeking to enter the international arena, flexing its muscle to become established as an imperialist colonial power. In this ideological climate, there was an immense interest not only in foreign countries and their raw materials, their plants and animals, but also in exotic peoples and their cultures. Völkerschauen, which might be translated as people shows, provided ethnographic peep shows of cultures perceived by Europeans as primitive and altogether alien and inferior, but at the same time as curiously exciting and even desirable others. Only a decade later, from America, Buffalo Bill's Wild West show would tour major European cities, but in the late 1870s in Germany, Karl Hagenbeck was the first to come up with the idea of satisfying the German colonial gaze by importing indigenous peoples from overseas to exhibit them and have them observed both as living objects of ethnographic research and as exotic fetishes of voyeuristic desires. 3 years previously, in 1877, Hagenbeck had presented to the public a group of Inuit from Greenland. In 1880, he tried to repeat the earlier success. He knew of the popular curiosity, and he may have banked on scientific support as well. In his memoirs, published in 1909, he praised his relationship with the Greenlanders, but he never mentions the economic flop and human catastrophe of his 1880 venture with Abraham and the others from Newfoundland. The story would not have fitted his self-celebratory success story. The general public of the time was most likely motivated by the colonialist curiosity described above, and the newspaper reports we read mostly catered to sensationalist interests. They do so usually in a condescending attitude, presenting the Inuit as naive or childlike creatures. There's also a detailed report of Tobias' fondness for children and their fondness of him. Besides, there was the more scholarly interest in ethnography, also catered to by some of the press. In general, however, the perceptual frame of newspaper reporters dictated some of the stereotypes they presented. That is, they constructed the Inuit as a dying race in accordance with popular notions about North Americans' noble but dying savages. Now they report how a polar bear at the zoo housing the Inuit became very excited by their appearance and recognized them as its natural enemies. I come to the scholarly interest. This was informed by Eurocentric ideas about the evolution of human races. It presents a classic example of the colonial gaze. Biologists, physicians, historians, anthropologists, linguists, and members of the fledgling Völkerkunde, people science, ethnography, or anthropology, were eager to weigh, measure, and interview primitives and to assign them their definite place within a hierarchically structured theory of human races and ethnocentric ideas about the genetic evolution of humans, which invariably placed Europeans complacently at the top. In his report on his examinations of the visitors from Labrador, Rudolf Virchow applauds the Moravians' civilizing success with Abraham and his family. The missionaries were successful in supporting the education of these people to such an extent that they developed their intelligence to a not inconsiderable degree and are capable of writing easily, of drawing, and of practicing several skills of a civilized life. By contrast, he describes Terjanjak and his family as completely heathenish and as possessing features that are eminently fit for learning about the primitive state of this people. But he does concede that all Inuit seem capable of becoming educated. In any case, the Christianized people prove that their brains indeed are able to develop, as it is also demonstrated by numerous samples of the artistic achievements even of the wild Eskimos, especially Abraham, who seems to have enjoyed a complete education, proves to be one of the most educated and smartest individuals one can see, according to my examinations. Virchow proceeded to weigh and measure his samples and to record some of their language. Throughout, his objective was to racially classify them and find out whether they constituted a race in themselves, or whether and how they were related to Mongolians in Asia or the Inuit of Greenland. Skin color, hair texture, length of arms and legs, width of feet, growth of beard were recorded with the same attention to minutiae as variations in clothing or equipment. The Inuit's clumsiness in using numbers that he speaks of, he concludes, strengthens the impression that the Eskimos are of a lower race. So if you can't do math, you are of a lower race. Okay. I am of a lower race. I was lousy in math. Interestingly, Virchow defends his and Hagenbeck's scientific interests against an article in Magdeburger Zeitung, which he quotes as having criticized the prevalent way of developing ideas about foreign races and the use of zoological gardens for the exposition of human beings, and had maintained that our sense for racial. In refuting this criticism, Virchow insists that there is a scientific interest for everybody who wants to get informed about the position. And then he relates, the most interesting part of his report is his description of Pingo's fit, or what he calls a psychic cramp, during his examination of her, which he describes as both a pathological or a shamanist reaction. Quote, you will probably be interested in learning something about the fit that I observed with Mrs. Bingo the other day. You have now seen how shy the daughter is. She looks like a wild animal that has been captured. The mother does not have this squeamish nature, but she's extremely suspicious, so that with every step she makes in any place that she does not know, one realizes how much the new environment causes grave concern within her. It was very hard to take her measurements, which was rather easy with the others. I started with the simplest and thus tried to convince her little by little that it was nothing harmful, but every new act caused her concern again, and when it was time to measure her body, she started shaking and turned into a state of alarm. While I was spreading her arms horizontally, because I wanted to take her fathom length, which seems to have never occurred in her entire life, she suddenly had a fit. She slipped underneath my arm and started carrying on all over in the room with such a fury and such a way as I have never seen before, although I encountered the most extraordinary fits of anger and cramps, be it simulated or real, as a long-term doctor in a prison. At first I expected it to turn into a hysterical catatonic fit. So it goes on. By comparison, the Moravian motivations seem more complex and often contradictory. From the very start, the missionaries were very critical of the economic venture and absolutely opposed to the idea of commercially exhibiting their neophytes in Europe. By contrast, they betrayed no qualms about exhibiting heathens. Their trust in Hagenbeck seems to us naive, their theological interpretation of the tragedy almost cynical. There are several letters and reports documenting how very opposed the missionaries were to Jacobson's attempt to recruit their Inuit. They told Jacobson right from the start, quote, we absolutely cannot allow our baptized people to be exhibited like wild animals outside in Europe for money. And this argument is repeated several times. While they felt responsible for their neophytes, the heathens from Nachvak were of little interest to them, except their wish to keep the heathens and the Christians separated, and Jacobson complied. The missionaries were also curious as to whether the outside world would perceive a difference between their baptized brethren and Taljanyak's family. While the whole missionary venture had economic interests in mind, the missionaries trying to minimize costs and maximize income from their baptized Eskimos, the trip to Europe brought them no gain. Indeed, it led to complications and growing insubordination from their charges, who could now compare fur prices in Europe and Labrador. The missionaries' greatest concern seems to have been containment. They wanted Abraham and his family to stay away from sinful contacts with Catholics and other denominations, as well as from contamination with materialist greed and learning the tricks of the trade. The aim seems to have been to keep the Eskimos in childlike ignorance on colonial economic dependence. At the same time, they hoped their mission might profit from Abraham's exposure to a better music in Europe. After Abraham and his family had left Labrador, the missionaries in Hebron sent recommendations to the European brethren as to how to treat their Eskimos over there. Accordingly, while the travelers were in Germany, local brethren and former missionaries provided social contacts and spiritual consolation for the group, whereas Tayanyak's people were left entirely to their own spiritual and social devices. Throughout, the missionaries and teachers seem to have been troubled by the fear that their pupils might bring shame upon them and disgrace the missionary project. After the Inuit's death, there are Moravian comments expressing gratitude and relief that Abraham and his family had remained faithful and disciplined to the very end. The pious brethren seem to have accepted the death of the Inuit as the working of God's providence, or even as God's vengeance for the neophytes' disobedience to their teachers. Moreover, while lamenting the loss of the Inuit brethren, the missionaries seem also to have felt a certain degree of relief, since the deaths of Abraham's group would discourage others, who had obediently stayed behind in Newfoundland, from going on a similar venture. Thus, the tragic deaths would serve to support missionary discipline and morale at home. The following letter from Hebron to Herrnhut, published in Missionsblatt aus der Brüdergemeinde, documents most clearly the Moravian ambivalent attitude. Relating to our Eskimos who had died last year in Europe, it is written from Hebron. Of course, we never expected at all that the local Eskimos would have to pay with their lives for the undertaking, that they would become homesick, Ulrike had already predicted. We are glad. Lieb ist es uns, because one day everything had to become so serious that Abraham would see his mistake and feel ashamed of it. Last winter, when there was great poverty, we were often thankful that Abraham did not stay here for our sake. How often would he have had to hear that he had rejected such high profits because of the teachers, that's the brothers, and that he had now had to suffer with them. The easiest way for us would always be to let the Eskimos live according to their own will. Abraham was our best violin player at church, and we will miss him a lot. We hoped he would profit from Germany for his own benefit and for ours, because he would hear good music for the first time. Now the Lord decided according to his own will and placed the homesick ones in a better land, saved them from sin and earthly misery, and at the same time taught the locals, the ones lusting for Europe, a lesson. Because if they had come back healthy and rich, the craving to go to Europe and to grow rich there would have become an epidemic among the other Eskimos, many of them who were looking at Abraham and his companions in envy last year are now silent and happy not to have gone with them. Since Mr. Hagenbeck, and in spite of his big losses, paid off all earnings honestly, the relatives of the deceased received the commendable sum of 1,120 marks. Unfortunately, suspicion is on the rise and is fomented maliciously by people who are not even involved, maintaining that, besides the suitcase of the deceased arrived from Hamburg, which, as a precaution, we had opened immediately on the beach in presence of the helmsman and the Eskimos, another bag had arrived containing belongings of Abraham and Tobias. People believe to have learned this from the captain or the helmsman. There's also talk of 5,000 marks which they supposed to have earned. Referring to this, and according to what the crew members tell them, from the newspapers they draw their own conclusions. When they hear that thousands came to see them in just one day, they think that all the money thus taken had belonged to their countrymen. Now, as everybody knows, Eskimos are not the greatest people at numerical systems or the art of calculation, and so it makes no difference to them if you multiply a number by 4 or 5. But in spite of their clean conscience, this suspicion hurts our brothers. And they have to learn, leave it to the Lord to vindicate them in the hearts of the people. For those themselves, unfortunately, this conviction is also a great misfortune. Despite all the things that happened, it would not be impossible that if they were asked again next year to go to Europe, some would go again, let themselves be seduced by the hope of becoming rich. This is an almost smug self-righteousness that is also evident in an entry in the minutes of the Elders' Conference in Herrnhut immediately after the death of the Inuit, which is based on a letter from Hebron of August 20th, quoted above. The minutes go even beyond the letter and state, in spite of most urgent pleading, Abraham could not be swayed, and therefore they, the missionaries, were free of all responsibilities for the consequences. Taking stock then of the whole venture, what were the results of this tragic trip to Europe? All Inuit members lost their lives, and while those who were baptized reportedly died in the hope of redemption, Tarjanyak seems to have died a broken man, bereft of his family, against whose disease his shamanistic powers had failed him. For Hagenbeck, according to Moravian sources, the whole venture turned into a financial disaster, which, however, he never mentions in his autobiography, which follows the Franklinian model. Virgil's reactions to the deaths are not recorded. Individual brethren who knew Abraham and met him again in Europe expressed their personal grief, but also their trust in divine providence. And the missionaries at Hebron, they obviously felt vindicated. The Lord had punished Abraham for his disobedience, and providence had shown that the outside was indeed full of lurking dangers. I'd like to talk about the literary context, Inuit autobiographical writings. My students and my own personal interest in and empathy for Abraham's story was aroused primarily by the human dimension and the geographic and cultural context and historical legacies which connect us. But there's also the scholarly interest in the text itself, which presents a pioneering accomplishment and a unique literary contribution to the genre of Inuit autobiography.